When we're presented with some of the near-term effects of our behavior on the environment, we often have some idea what to do. If there's too much plastic trash, we can stop using so much plastic. If there's a danger of fire, we can trim back the stuff around our houses and be extremely careful with flame. But when the whole planet is in trouble, that can boggle the mind. That's just one of the observations Roger Gottlieb makes in his book, Morality and the Environmental Crisis. Roger Gottlieb is a professor of philosophy at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Massachusetts. He's also a prolific author and editor with more than 20 books bearing his name, many focused on the intersection of religion and environmentalism. Roger Gottlieb, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So give us a square one. Does a person have to have a religious tradition or practice to understand or appreciate your book?
No, not at all. It's to make it overly simple, this is a book of environmental ethics. But I'm raising the question, not just what's right to do, but examining the ways in which it's very difficult to do what's right when the culture in which we live, virtually the entire global civilization, carries an enormous environmental weight, which not only means the destruction of countless species and the alteration of earth, air, and water, but also destruction of countless human beings. UN estimates there are 5 to 10 million climate refugees every single year. Other health organizations estimate that 3 to 6 million people die or have increased risk of death from air pollution every single year. That's close to a Holocaust every other year just from air pollution that really could be drastically reduced if we got off of coal. So we live in a time when the most common objects that we encounter are threatening. So if this makes everybody anxious, you could have a nice glass of water. But then again, what's in the water? Is there lead, like there was in Flint, Michigan? And if there is, how would we find out? Because after all, the people, the authorities in Flint knew that there was lead for years before they said anything. So never mind the glass of water. Let's take something out of a nice water bottle. But wait a minute, it better not have BPA in it, which is a carcinogenic chemical. And that's why the REI fancy super-duper water bottles now say no BPA. But what if there's something else in the water bottle that we don't know about, that hasn't been discovered yet? See what I mean? On and on. There's the global issues and global warming and the melting glaciers far away. But there's also the objects closer to us and our own breasts and prostates, which are much more likely to get cancer. I could go on like this for a whole hour if you'd like.
But you're making a great point here. The fact is that, I mean, if we consider the enormity of our power upon the planet and therefore upon each other, you can see why people would be happier in some cases just getting into denial.
Yes, there's denial and there's avoidance, and I think, you know, the two of them sort of share center stage as the most significant environmental problems. Problem with avoidance is that you have to know something is there in order to avoid it. You know, if you think of avoiding a pothole, you can't avoid a pothole unless you see it. So the people who are avoiding this, or the people who are denying it, somewhere unconsciously, subconsciously, they know something's wrong. Anybody over 30 can sense the change in the weather. You know, I have moths around the lights on my porch around Thanksgiving. They used to be finished by October 1st or so. I can wear a fall jacket through most of the winter now. So, you know, I heard your weather forecast. More record, perhaps record temperatures. God, that's a surprise, right?
Right.
Unseasonably warm? No, the seasons aren't what they used to be. So we're aware of this, but then the sort of the ADD sets in, and what's on the screen? What's the latest tweet from the idiot president? What's the latest sports thing or The Voice TV show or something? On and on and on. The endless hyperstimulation of meaningless nonsense that takes our attention away from the most profound facts of our lives. And that most profound fact is that we are creatures of nature. We are bodies, excuse me, and that we are poisoning our environment, which includes us.
So obviously this is something that can be dealt with in denial or avoidance, as you point out. But then there's also moral malaise you describe in the introduction, which makes me wonder if some of us are acutely aware of what's going on and too bummed out to act on global warming.
Yes, it's very depressing to know that your daily life, your drive, the flipping on the lights, is part of a civilization that's destructive. I think people want to believe that they are essentially good, unless you're a sociopath or a psychopath. You believe what you're doing is right. If you are a jihadist who blows up buildings, you believe you're doing it to serve Allah. If you're operating a drone from 8,000 miles away and you bomb an Islamic wedding, you think you're doing it to defend the West against the extremists. We all have a story that we tell that says we're good people, or if we're not, we're doing the best we can. And sadly, to be part of this civilization right now is to be part of the problem. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't millions of people who are trying simultaneously to be part of the solution. But it's depressing to drive, to eat meat, things like that. If you have any knowledge at all, you know this is bad, and the consequences are bad. So then what else can we do? Well, there's a whole bunch of things we can do that, as the saying goes, I put in the book. But it's not. It's the fundamental orientation has to be, what are we doing as moral people, as individuals in our daily life, and as individuals as hopefully part of a collective political movement?
This is about where you introduce the term ecocide. I mean, this is something we do consciously, or does an act not stop to become deliberate?
It's the difference between the Holocaust and the current ecocide is that the vast majority of people are not willing the destruction of the Earth. It's happening by a decentered, non-centralized collection of forces. Yet at the same time, there's a vast inequality of power. I, driving my little fuel-efficient car and turning on electric lights, are very different from, let's say, Exxon Corporation. Exxon knew 30 to 40 years ago about global warming, and it sent out internal memos warning its installations, make yourself stronger, raise you up, get away from the coast, so forth and so on. At the same time that they spent somewhere between $10 and $15 million to a PR firm to create doubt about global warming. Ironically and sadly, it was the same PR firm that was hired to cast doubt on the relation between cancer and smoking. So the people in Exxon who did this are a species of war criminal. Hundreds of thousands, millions of people are already dying from the effects of climate change. And these people cheerfully got up in the morning and said, how can we preserve our opportunity to get this stuff out of the ground and sell it, and the consequences be damned?
Okay, so Exxon as war criminal is a place to start off into a break, and we'll come back and pick that up on the other side. Roger Gottlieb from Worcester Polytech, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, professor of philosophy, author of Morality and the Environmental Crisis. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Roger Gottlieb, professor of philosophy at Worcester Polytech in Massachusetts. He's an author of many books, author or editor of more than 20 books bearing his name, looking often at the intersection of religion and environmentalism. And here we are again. This book is called Morality and the Environmental Crisis, How We View Global Warming and What We're Doing About It, If Anything. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I wanted to come back to that point you just made about Exxon as war criminal. You really think it is to that extent?
You know, in Boston some years ago, we had what was known as the Marathon bombing, as three bombs were placed at the finish line of the marathon. Now, if you think, well, let's say they hadn't timed the bombs to go off that day. Suppose they'd timed them to go off 15 or 20 years later. Would they be any less terrorists? Suppose they put much smaller bombs, but they distributed them in 10,000 or 50,000 or a million homes. Would they be any less terrorists? Suppose only a third of the bombs went off. You see where I'm going with this. The degree to which people knowingly create and distribute poisonous chemicals, pesticides, furniture polish, things of that kind, the degree to which people defend and enhance the use of fossil fuels are creating millions of climate refugees, millions of deaths, and it's only going to get worse. And these people, and it's going to continue. It takes makes me cough, the whole thing. When I think about air pollution, I start to cough. it's only going to get worse as the time goes on. We estimate that in 20 or 30 years, there's going to be more plastic in the ocean than fish. How did we come to a place where there's more plastic than fish in the ocean? The permafrost is melting, and out of that will come huge amounts, trillions upon trillions of tons of CO2. So on and on like that. It's more decentered than just dropping a bomb or lining up people and shooting them or gassing them in ovens. But the consequences are unimaginably huge, and people who are knowingly doing that. So we're all responsible. I drive my car, and I plug my appliances in like everybody else. Only some are guilty, those are people who are at the center of the societies in which they live, or the centers of the economy, the center of politics.
All right, guilty versus responsible. I appreciate that that nuance there. The Bible mentions environmental destruction. Does it mention it often?
Well, if you look at the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, where that's where the stuff is that you'd want to look for, it's very mixed. You have the stuff about humans dominating the earth, but you also have the fact that the first generations of people commanded by God were all vegans or fruit and nutarians. And you have clearly the sense that people are dominating the other species, but there's also limitations. The one I like the best is that if your enemy's donkey is pushed down onto the ground by its load, you're supposed to go and help the donkey to stand up. Your enemy's donkey, not just your friend's donkey. Also, on the sabbatical year when food isn't planted, food naturally grows with seeds left over from the previous year. Well, at that time, you're supposed to leave that food. You don't gather it yourself. You leave it for the poor people and also for wild animals, not just your own domestic animals, but for wild animals. So there's a variety of teachings about nature and traditional religions. Not surprisingly, they're not fully adequate to what we're going through now because we didn't have the technological power to change the acidity of the ocean. We've made it much more acid, or to render mother's breast milk unfit to drink because of pollutants in the mother's body. We couldn't do anything like that thousands of years ago.
Roger, in our time, do religions, and I mean not their leaders, but the religions themselves, take much note of climate change?
Well, actually, among the dominant institutions of our planet, I would say religions over the last 30 years, along with scientists, have been the leaders in this. 30 years ago, Pope John Paul II said, we need to return nature to being the sister of humanity. And that's a fundamental shift for a church which for thousands of years took every indigenous tradition which taught about nature being kin and tried to eliminate it by killing the people or converting them. You had the World Council of Churches, which is an umbrella organization of Protestant groups, attending many international climate change meetings and putting forth the idea of convergence, which is a very, very simple but profound idea that the average amount of greenhouse gases put out by the average American should equal the average amount of greenhouse gases put out by the average citizen of, let's say, Bangladesh or Senegal. Now, these are extremely radical proposals, much more radical, interestingly, than that coming out of the labor union groups, and I'm sure Marx is rolling over in his grave at that realization. The Council of Catholic Bishops in the United States sent pamphlets on how to respond to climate change to 100,000 parishes in the United States. I could go on and on with this. Is it enough? No, it's never enough. But the voices have been quite strong.
We are talking to Roger Gottlieb from Worcester Polytechnic Institute about Morality and the Environmental Crisis, his latest book here on the Jefferson Exchange. Here's a phone call from Steve in Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange.
Howdy. I'm beginning to wonder, like a snowball rolling downhill, if there's going to be a point of no return. I've already heard on NPR today that a million species are due to go extinct in the foreseeable future. And I'm wondering how long it's going to be till we kill off ourselves or move to a different habitat like Mars, whatever.
All right, but how soon we make this planet uninhabitable? Thanks for that,
well,
Steve.
I'm not sure it'll be uninhabitable, though it might be. I mean, if you really want to ask the experts about the effect of dramatic climate change, go dig up a dinosaur and ask them. Climate changed and not too long after, there were no more dinosaurs. But, no, I don't think it's going to eliminate the human species. I don't think it's going to destroy nature, which is a phrase people often use. I think it's going to be a radical shift. I think it's possible the sort of the mildest version would be a death of 50 to 100 to 200 million people from this. Could be up to a billion or more. Could destroy the foundations of modern industrial society. Because imagine what happens when all the cell phone towers blow down because the storms are so strong. Imagine what would happen if you have six huge hurricanes going up the east coast of the United States. city after city after city. And then what happens to money for education, for health care for the elderly or the disabled? You get the picture. What it'll be, I don't know. I think that worrying about the details of the future are perhaps a mistake, or if not a mistake, not something I like to do a great deal of. I can see what's going on now. I can see the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which is a soup or stew of plastic garbage in the middle of the Pacific that's as big as the United States. I can see the toxins in the bloodstreams of newborn infants anywhere in this country. I can see that. And I can see that whatever happens in the future, I would like to have be able to say to the next generation or the generation after that, gee whiz, I tried. I would like to be able to give love now, whatever the ultimate consequences of everybody else's actions in the future.
You see the Enlightenment having some influence still, many hundreds of years later, in our response to the ecological crisis?
Well, you know, the Enlightenment, there's the good news and the bad news. The good news was respect for science rather than religious tradition as giving us a literal account of the origins of the world. The idea of individual human rights is, I think, still a very powerful idea. However, the Enlightenment also tend to think of human beings as isolated individuals. If you think of human rights, they're sort of like the lines on a parking lot, right? You can drive any car you want as long as you stay within the lines. Well, that's good and appropriate for a certain period in human history. But right now, we're too interconnected. You know, I drive my car and the storms in Bangladesh kill 20,000 people. So along with rights, we need a kind of concern, a kind of empathy, a kind of, you should pardon the soppy old hippie expression, a kind of love, or at least a kind of care. After all, it's the natural world that cares for us. It's the natural world which created us out of evolution. It's the natural world that produces water and air and insects that pollinate plants. Can we not show some care and love to, again, another cliche, Mother Nature? It's a cliche, but what else created us? So the Enlightenment is important. Respect for science is important. But you also have to remember that science serves funding, right? Maybe there was a time you could do science by yourself in your basement. No more. So the direction of science depends on what the funders want. Do they want profit? We'll get science aimed at profit. Do they want military power? We'll get science aimed at weapons. Do we want to find a way to coexist with the other life forms on this planet and not poison ourselves? That's what we want science to serve, that interest and that funding.
Roger Gottlieb, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called Morality and the Environmental Crisis. You can join our conversation here on the Jefferson Exchange by phone, 800-838-3760, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Andy in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, hi, Jeff. Hi, Mr. Gottlieb.
Hi.
Thank you.
It's a great conversation. I think we're on the right track here. James Hillman wrote a book called The Soul's Code, and in it he says that the ecological disaster that we're facing is more related to what he calls a parental fallacy that's deadly to the individual self-awareness that is killing the world. And he says until this psychological fallacy is set straight, no compassionate campaign of multiculturalism or environmentalism, no field trips, no Peace Corps, no bird watching or whale songs can fundamentally reattach me to the world. And what he's arguing for is that we really need to get in touch with nature, that we've settled for more in terms of consumerism, instead of searching for the beyond, that what he calls the somewhere over the rainbow yearning that we all experience when we hear that song, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just what I want to offer.
All right. Thanks for that, Andy.
Take a walk. Yes, I think the importance of connecting to nature in a way that promotes relationship, as opposed to nature as spectacle or nature as I climbed that mountain, I've now bagged, 30 10,000 footers or whatever, or nature as adventure with a very noisy machine like a jet ski. I have students in my philosophy and the environment class pick one tree and visit it three or four times a week for every week of our 7-week terms. There is no simple underlying cause of the environmental crisis. It's too complex for that. Clearly, the out-of-control need to expand of capitalism and the associated political power given to the largest corporations is a central cause. However, what's internal is important as well, our ADD in regard to practically everything except the next phone call or tweet, our dependence on really unnecessary, quote, luxuries, unquote, our short-sightedness and our political passivity are also problems. And yet, when Hillman, who's a very important psychologist, a splendid, brilliant man, when he talks about what's inside us, well, where did we get what's inside us? It comes from outside. The outside becomes the inside, and the inside becomes the outside. So it's a struggle, as we might say, on many fronts. There's the front of simply getting the coal plants replaced, and there's the front of turning off the screens, going outside, and sitting with one tree, sitting in one place, caring for one species. It's all these things simultaneously.
Let's take another call. Here is Richard in Glendale. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Roger Gottlieb.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call. What he just said is, I believe everything he said. My comment is that, and it kind of is our problem, I think, is that we just, we're so divided as a nation. We just can't get together. We're Republicans or Democrats. And if we could just be Americans and look at this problem, we'd probably get a lot farther ahead. That's all I wanted to say.
All right. Thank you for that.
It's very sad when people on a sinking ship, instead of trying to repair the ship, spending 8/10 of their energy fighting each other. I think there is some small grounds of hope, at least on the environmental front, where you do see things like the Evangelical Environmental Network, which is a portion of the evangelical community. Generally, that community is very conservative, doesn't pay much attention to the environment, focuses on things like being against homosexual marriage and that sort of thing. But there is an Evangelical Environmental Network that actually led to a split in one of the major evangelical organizations. And years ago, they sponsored a campaign called What Would Jesus Drive? And they went around the country talking about transportation choices and the golden rule, love thy neighbor, as applied to transportation. And they ended up at the country's largest Christian rock festival. Now, I'm, you know, one of these sort of caricatured Jewish leftist Marxist professors, hippie professors, who didn't know that there was a large Christian rock festival, but there was. So you have groups like that. And you have younger people, even among evangelicals, who take climate change seriously. Is it enough? Well, sure, it's not enough, but there are certain bright features on the horizon. Things are being talked to now in national political scene that weren't talked to. In 2016, the presidential debates had about 4 minutes, I think it was, on climate change. Now it's the major plank of somebody running for president, Inslee from the state of Washington, your neighbor. People are talking about the Green New Deal. People are not ignoring climate change anymore. They're just not. And that's a fundamental shift.
Another call here from Nicholas in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Roger Gottlieb, who wrote Morality and the Environmental Crisis.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Doing well, thanks.
I am concerned that when we have discussions about climate change, and statistically, it's been shown that when you ask people what the greatest threat to the environmental world is, they say climate change. But realistically, the greatest current threat to the environmental world and the thing that's causing the most extinctions, the two things, are habitat loss and the introduction of invasive species. And I worry that if we don't make that distinction, people will not recognize what the greatest threats right now are.
All right.
Yeah, I'm not sure I want to rank the threats. It's true that, I mean, the one analogy people make is rivets on an airplane wing. If you look at the plane when you're on an airplane ride and you see these rivets holding the wing together, well, one falls off, what the hell? Two falls off, what the hell? Three falls off. At what point do so many rivets fall off that the wing falls off? And as we eliminate species, and certainly the precipitous decline in insects and precipitous decline in bats is going to play havoc with agriculture. And it's also, I think, it's just a shame. And I think one looks at what we're doing, for what purpose, for more palm oil, we're destroying the rainforest. to cut down the rainforest and make grazing land for cattle, to make hamburgers for McDonald's. Is this really the way we want to live? So the destruction of species and the consequent sort of terrible effects on our own ecosystem health, and just on a sense of loneliness, look what we've lost. Look what we've destroyed. For the length of time that I've been on this broadcast, four species have been rendered extinct by human action. It's about every 11 minutes, people estimate. What a shame that this is the best we can do. I mean, we've got 700 different TV channels and God knows how many TV series, and we've got new phones every 9 months. How wonderful is that? But, you know, the snow on the top of Mount Everest would be too toxic to drink. The squids 3 miles under the surface of the ocean have furniture chemicals in their bodies. And pretty soon, a lot of those animals and insects and birds are just not going to be here.
The moral component to the warming of the earth, and our further discussion by Roger Gottlieb in his book, The Morality and the Environmental Crisis. We'll come back and talk more with Roger and take more phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're having a rousing discussion of the moral impacts of global warming and how we deal with it on a moral basis with Roger Gottlieb. He is a professor of philosophy at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Massachusetts. He's written a book called Morality and the Environmental Crisis. And this is the conversation you're welcome to join on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here is Skeeter in Eugene. Welcome to the exchange with Roger Gottlieb.
Hiya. Thanks for a great program. I totally agree that we as Americans are really divided in our various camps. And rather than us all thinking that we're Americans rather than Democrats and Republicans and joining in crowds chanting USA, USA, frankly, I'd really recommend that we all start thinking of ourselves as earthlings. We are planetary people, and we're either going to go down together or we're all going to survive together. So I hope that we can all get together. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for that, Skeeter. Appreciate
it. I think that's very insightful. It's interesting that the first human in the Bible called Adam, where the Hebrew word for earth is Adamah, so one might translate Adam as earthling. Yes, there. I think there's the illusion, which has a certain limited truth in it, that we're going to be in a kind of gated community, right? That the big storms will roll over Bangladesh and kill 20, 30, 50,000 people at a time, and the droughts will destroy Central Africa, so you have millions upon millions of refugees trying to escape them. It'll destabilize Syria, so you have hundreds of thousands of dead there and half the country displaced. But we in America, we're going to be all right. But you guys out in the West Coast, maybe you're starting to learn from the wildfires. No, you're not going to escape. And the people in the Midwest who had those huge floods in April, learning the same thing. Yes, it's going to be better for the rich than the poor, things generally are. But we're not going to escape, which is why the Department of Defense, hardly a sort of washed-up old hippie Marxist like me, Department of Defense years ago said that the greatest foreign policy issue for the United States was climate change. And so the denial of climate change is actually, whenever any Republican politician says that, he's going against the Department of Defense. So what does it take to think of ourselves as citizens of the earth? Well, it would mean, I would think, among other things, and there's a chapter on this in the book, that we encourage a kind of ecological democracy, that we think of all the species as being part of our community, not just the human ones. We have ways to represent the interests of human beings who can't talk, like newborns or people in comas or with Alzheimer's. What about the tree people? What about the four-legged people or the people with wings? How could we represent their interests and take their interest into account in social policy? That would be a fundamental shift.
Do we have the beginnings of something like ecological democracy by having agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency?
We have tiny beginnings, yes. When private property rights can be overridden by Endangered Species Act, you have something moving in that direction. Sadly, these things are very hard to put in practice and very easy to overturn, as we've seen with the current administration, which is trying to dismantle practically every environmental regulation it can get its hands on. A country of Ecuador has talked about the rights of nature in its new constitution. So you have the beginnings of this. It's a vast human struggle that's taking place now to recognize actually who we are and what we're doing. And one of the things that distinguishes the environmental crisis from every other sort of social justice concern is how complex and multifaceted and the changes that it demands. I mean, if you think of the civil rights movement, difficult struggle, people were beaten, people were killed, churches were set on fire, blown up. But it's not hard to understand, you know, let black people vote, let them eat in any restaurant they want, let them get money from a bank, let them have equal treatment under the law. Any 9-year-old can understand that. But the progression of moving to a sustainable energy system, that's pretty hard to figure out. Which pesticides to use, if any, is hard to figure out. See what I'm saying? This is the great challenge of our generation, and I think generations are limited for at least another century, because the amount of damage and poisons that we've produced already means that we're going to be facing this for a very long time.
Even if we do start approaching it in terms like the ecological democracy you bring up in the book here, when we start thinking about things like nature having rights, do we get hung up on the difficulty of establishing legal doctrine there, or is it more a case of we don't want to?
Well, I don't think of the term rights as really applicable to nature, because if you have the right to vote and I have the right to vote, then we have these separate but equal rights to vote. But as a human being, as a living organism, I'm going to displace plants, I'm going to eat plants, I'm going to pull weeds out of my garden, and so is everybody else. So it's a question of turning in the other direction and saying, well, what kind of life do I want to live? Do I want to live a kind of life that's motivated by greed, thoughtlessness, environmental ADD, competition, violence, and militarism? Well, we see how great that is, which is why the richest country in the history of the world, the United States, is very low in terms of mental health and very low in terms of measures of happiness. I can coexist with a tree and still have my own life, because as the tree's life is worth having, so is mine, but not under the current set of environmental practices. That's what has to shift, not giving the tree rights, but representing its interests. If you think of family life, we don't have family arguments in terms of rights. Right? Joey wants to go play baseball, but it's the weekend when we're supposed to visit grandma in the nursing home. Well, we don't argue about grandma's rights or Joey's rights. We talk about love and care and compassion and respect and flourishing. And I would like to see those words used when we relate to the natural world.
We got an interesting email here from Reese Maxwell, who was the executive director of the Whole Earth Nature School. And he writes, I run this nonprofit in Eugene. We connect thousands of children ages 3 through 17 with nature every year. We teach outdoor living skills, nature awareness skills, ancestral skills like fire making and shelter building and ethnobotany. Our biggest challenge is convincing adults to join our adult programs. We have a free monthly tracking club that nary an adult will attend. We put together adult skills classes, and rarely will adults sign up for them. And he puts in bold here, we shy away from doom and gloom, so what instead can we use to help motivate people as adults to get out and get connected through being mentored in Nature Connection? That again from Reese Maxwell.
Okay, well, I would try it this way. I mean, I'm big on doom and gloom. That's why nobody invites me to cocktail parties. I'm a real bummer. But try the following difficult, but I think illustrative example. Imagine, God forbid, that your mother, your aged mother, was in the hospital and prognosis isn't very good. You're not sure, but it doesn't look good. Would you spend all your time and emotional energy just worrying about what the future is going to hold? Or would you say, look, I don't know how long Mom has, but I'll go to her room, I'll hold her hand, I'll sing to her, I'll stroke her hair, I'll make her feel comfortable. I will show love as much as I can and in as many ways as I can, whatever the future holds. And rather than doom and gloom, I would say, here's a chance for you to connect with and show some love to these beautiful entities, these beautiful places, these beautiful beings, to expand your horizons. Will it work? I don't know. Somebody would have to put down their phone for a weekend or an afternoon or however long these programs are. So I'm not against prognosis, but I also think that the important question is to sort of collapse our emotional energy into the presence. What's the most significant, loving, caring way I can live right now? And that's why even if there's a million pieces of trash on the roadside, you don't throw another one out of your car, because whatever it would do about the future, it would change something now, which would change your condition as a moral being. And you don't want to be that moral being who added to the trash one more time. You recycle much better, and even better, if it's a coffee cup, get a reusable coffee cup.
All right, so people can think in terms of small things, although you say, you know, if you just drive a Prius and use cloth bags, you're not necessarily having an impact. But is part of the issue that we do understand small things well, and it's the big things like love, just thinking in terms of love and thinking in terms of the whole planet that really trip us up?
It's all of them. It's all the things at once. If you make an analogy, ending racism requires small things like not using the N-word or not telling racist jokes. It also requires big things like the Voting Rights Act. And there's no contradiction or tension between those small daily things and the larger social policy changes. Same thing for feminism and the same thing for the environment. The more we integrate this kind of thinking into our daily lives to whatever extent we can, the more likely I should hope, we're going to be to go on a demonstration, support the Sierra Club, vote for the environmental candidate, raise issues in our church or a town meeting or our neighborhood or our educational institution or a radio station. The two things go together. It's not one or the other. It's not trying to calculate which is more important. Which one is more important? Yes, that's my answer. Yes, they're both more important.
All of them. Here's another call from Carter in Wolf Creek. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Roger Gottlieb.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
One of the things that I would like to point out here is that the word moral itself is rooted in behavior and particularly specifically custom, social custom in early societies. So that's the word. And so I'm particularly interested in the critical nature of how I behave, how I'm speaking in the way that I'm speaking right now, and the technical systems involved with it. And I personally, in my life, this, what we're talking about here in this program, has to do with what goes on in the mind that's speaking. And it's an internal matter, ultimately. And in that regard, and speaking in the first person term here, the Tao Te Ching has been very meaningful, very meaningful to me in maintaining humane behavior in this personal life, and also Advaita Vedanta and various aspects of Buddhism. And I told the screener, who I talked to just before coming on the air, that I am not advocating in my speaking now that people go out and join various organizations that represent these things. I'm talking about an individual, step-by-step personal matter. Now, one question I have for the speaker is, I am deeply interested, passionately interested in what neuroscience of the last 20 years has to say about what we're discussing.
All right. Thanks for that, Carter.
the most I could say about what I know about neuroscience, not my field, as we like to say, is that virtuous states like compassion and gratitude are a lot better for our health than greed, competition, and meanness. And they've established this in a variety of different ways. It's also the case that we have what's so-called mirror neurons, which enable us to pick up and respond to the emotional states of other people. I would believe that these mirror neurons function not just with other human beings, but certainly with our pets. You can pick up a miserable dog or a happy dog. And you can, more subtle ways, pick up a miserable tree or a happy tree. So we are by nature open to the world around us. The emphasis on individual rights, individual freedom, individual choice was necessary at a certain point in our history. Now what needs to be recognized is a return to the reality of our relationality. A small point about Eastern thought. The great thing about Eastern thought, environmentally speaking, is that in Eastern traditions, you don't have this big fundamental separation between the mind and the body, humanity and nature. That's not the way they operate. For them, the mind and the body are similar stuff, just on a continuum, like the difference between steam and ice. The problem in the Eastern traditions generally is that they have no tradition of social justice or the prophetic witness kind of thing that you get in the biblical prophets. And that's something that you get in the Western traditions much more. So you really need a kind of combination. But there are movements within Hinduism and Buddhism, certainly, which recognize the religious and moral necessity of action on environmental issues. There's a whole trend in Buddhism called engaged Buddhism, which is Buddhism brought into social change.
Roger, just about half a minute left. I mean, you describe yourself as Mr. Doom and Gloom, but I mean, do you advocate us doing the motions anyway, even though you do feel gloomy about this?
I advocate trying to live the most loving and caring and connected life one can. That's with people. That's with trees, that's with the air, that's with the people around us, and the people 12,000 miles away who are affected by what we do to the atmosphere. I think that ultimately the only source of a happy life, if one is indeed possible in a time of great social change, great social terror, the only source of a happy life is going to be living by self-awareness and gratitude and acceptance and compassion and love, and that we do that with other people and with the world.
The book is called Morality and the Environmental Crisis. It's the work of Roger Gottlieb at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. You will think things you've never thought before. Roger, thank you for that.
Thank you very much.